last year was 240 days. It's just beginning to show. The snow on the roof is increasing, and in fact, the roof is getting wider. The exhaustion level does mount, and just as we figured they weren't going and traded in our seats to make sure we could get here today, suddenly they decided they were going to go, and we were left without seats on that flight. Went back and spent the night in Atlanta and took off today. Thank you for the graciousness with which you accepted that change. And I want to thank my colleagues for their understanding too. It doesn't often happen, but every now and then it does and it can happen. It's an honor to be with you here at the Kenya Christian Fellowship of America. We are privileged to have one of your very own in John and Leah Jeroge and their boys on our team. It's been wonderful to have him not only as a colleague and as a teammate, but as one who really leads our staff devotions every week. It's an incredible story to see how God has used him and how he's using him even in our midst. So thank you for sharing John with us. His heart is very much with all of you and in his homeland, and we often talk about the burden that he carries for Kenya. And I understand that. I was born and raised in India and moved to the West when I was only 20. But I go back to India 3 or 4 times a year, and there's a Hindi song that's quite popular. It goes like this in Hindi. Let me just repeat it in Hindi and then translate it. It says, Mera juta hai Japani, patloon Englishtani, sar par lal topi Rusi, phir bhi dil hai Hindustani. My shoes may be Japanese, my trousers English, my hat may be Russian, but my heart is still Indian. That's the way the song goes. Oh, a very, very popular song indeed, and you cannot outrun that which flows within your veins. And so we're delighted to have John with us and always carrying that burden. Also want to thank you, Joseph, for those very kind words. I'm not worthy of it. Thank you for that encouragement. It always reminds us that our labor is not in vain, because you never know whose life you're touching, at what stage in life, at what crossroads moment, and how it is that God uses you sometimes even when you are totally unaware of who is listening on the other side. Just now as I was sitting there, that little guy there tapped me on the shoulder, and his father tells me that he watches me on YouTube all the time. So I guess he can grow up saying I watched horror movies when I was growing up. Watching Ravi's face on YouTube. But thank you, and thank you, Brother Duncan, too, for your kind words of introduction. I trust your work will continue to prosper and be blessed and multiply over the years to come. I've been asked to speak tonight on the theme of pleasure, the problem of pleasure. Now, who would have ever thought that the word problem and pleasure go together? I remember some years ago, the first time I was tackling that subject, I still remember I was in an elevator in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And they were all the businessmen were coming down for their what they call happy hour. I've always marveled about that. Must be a pretty sad life if you have only one happy hour every day. But they were coming down for their happy hour, and I had my Bible tucked under my arm, and then somebody said to me, "Are you a preacher?" I said, "I'm afraid so." And one of them said, "Are you speaking somewhere tonight?" I said, "Yes." He said, "What are you speaking on?" I said, "The problem of pleasure." He said, "I didn't know it was a problem." I said, "That tells you how big a problem it really is." We must understand that oftentimes we ask the question about the existence of God when we deal with the problem of pain. Isn't it interesting? Even the pantheist or the non-theist will often talk about Mother Earth. But when they are wanting to blame anybody for anything, it's Father God. Mother Earth may be the provider. Father God is the accused when anything goes wrong. We don't think of how every good and perfect gift comes from above, from the Father of all lights, in whom there is not even a shadow of turning. problem of pleasure. We very seldom ask, what are the guidelines? What parameters? What boundaries? Are there any fences we must not cross? It was G.K. Chesterton who said, whenever you remove any fence, always pause long enough to ask why it was put there in the first place. Unlimited pleasure ultimately leads to unlimited regret. I find it ironic that the man who typified pleasure in his time, Oscar Wilde, on his gravestone chose to put a verse from the book of Job. Job is hardly identified with pleasure. His name is synonymous with suffering. And at Oscar Wilde's funeral in Paris, I wrote a book on an imaginary conversation between Jesus and Oscar Wilde. I called it Sense and Sensuality. When I was researching his life and went into Paris and visited the very place where he lay dying when he was in his 40s, and then the church where he had his funeral was performed, which ironically was the same church with the funeral of Blaise Pascal. And so I put a conversation, an imaginary conversation, between Jesus, Pascal, and Oscar Wilde. And the irony of it is, in Oscar Wilde's funeral service, there was not one note of music sung. Ironic that even a life that was spawning dandyism, hedonism unbridled, music which is associated as the language of the imagination, wasn't even there at his funeral. The man who had a lot in his time, accumulated much, learned much, spoke much, celebrated much, is the one who raised the question this way. Solomon, I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish, and what does pleasure really accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women, singers and a harem as well, the delights of the heart of man. I became greater far by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. And in all this, my wisdom stayed with me. That's fascinating. That's fascinating that he interjects that line. While I was in the enjoyment of all of these ecstasies and extravagances, my wisdom stayed with me, which means there was some voice still guiding him through it. And then he says this, I denied myself nothing that my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all of my work, but this was the reward for all of my labor. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind, nothing was gained under the sun. A chasing after the wind, nothing was gained under the sun. That phrase is the guiding line for the book of Ecclesiastes. What he really means under the sun, if there is no transcendent perspective, if there is no voice coming into this closed system, if these 70 years is all we have with which to live and enjoy, And there is really no God speaking into all of this. It is all a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. But he realized soon that there was a voice that could be heard and ought to be heard, and that the beginning of all wisdom was ultimately to keep his commandments and to do our duty before God. One of my favorite writers is an Englishman who spent most of his ministry years in Australia and New Zealand. His name is Frank Borehm, B-O-R-E-H-A-M, Frank Borehm. He's the author of over 50 volumes of essays. I don't know of a better Christian essayist that I have read who wrote in such a prolific manner. His books, the titles alone, are an enormous blessing. And in one of his books called Wisps of Wildfire, in an essay called Phoebe's Perplexity, he has these words: "Laughter, merriment, and fun were quite evidently intended to occupy a large place in this world. Yet on no subject under the sun has the church displayed more embarrassment and confusion. One might almost suppose that here we have discovered an important phase of human experience on which Christianity is criminally reticent, a terra incognita which no intrepid prophet had explored, a silent sea upon whose waters no ecclesiastical adventurer had ever burst, a dark and eerie country upon which no sun had ever shone." Dr. Jowett tells us of the devout old Scotsman who on Saturday night locked up the piano and unlocked the organ, reversing the process last thing on the Sabbath evening. The piano is the sinner, the organ is the saint. Dr. Parker used to tell us what wax merry about this man who regarded table games as a gift from heaven, while billiards he deemed to be a stepping stone to perdition. The play we condemn, it is an anathema to us, the same play or a vastly inferior one screened on a film we delightedly admire. One Christian follows the round of gaiety with the maddest of the merry. Another wears a hair shirt and starves himself into a skeleton. One treats life as all a frolic, another as all a funeral. We swerve from the Scylla of aestheticism to the Charybdis of asceticism. We swing like a pendulum from the indulgence of the Epicurean to the severities of the Stoic, failing to recognize with the author of Ecce Homo that it is the glory of Christianity. While rejecting the absurdities of each, it combines the cardinal excellencies of both. We allow without knowing why we allow. We ban without knowing why we prohibit. We compound for sins we are inclined to by damning those we have no mind to. We are at sea without chart or compass. Our theories of pleasure are in hopeless confusion. Is there no definite doctrine of amusement? Is there no philosophy of fun? There must be, there has to be, and there is. What a profound statement of how we are on the high seas without chart or compass on the issue of pleasure. We ban without knowing why we ban. We celebrate without knowing why we celebrate. We swerve from the Scylla of asceticism to the Charybdis of aestheticism. We move with a pendular movement, not knowing how to find a balance and how to find our definitions. And you know what, ladies and gentlemen? We are living at a time in American history where we've completely lost our way on these matters. We have no chart or compass. We deal with issues today without any ultimate source of definition, except with the autocracy of power arrogated to ourselves. We have lost our definition for so many things. And if anybody dares suggest that there is such a thing as an absolute, he or she becomes the mocked one and the derelict in society. The relativists today are like those trying to find what time it is, but have thrown the clock away, and even the sundial is not of any help to them anymore. How do we find answers? I want to give to you three principles that I think are extremely helpful. I wish I could tell you I thought of these principles all on my own. No, I didn't. The message, by God's grace, I trust, I was able to put together. But the three principles I have borrowed from Boreham's essay, and they are so profound and so practical at the same time. Here's the first principle. All of these things actually happen in a state of war. In Judges 7, Gideon is going to face the Midianites. And like any general, he says, I need the biggest army I can put together because I'm facing a vast army out there. So he's got 32,000 able-bodied men. And God says to him while he's in prayer, you've got a problem. You've got too many men. I want you to drop them down. And God says, what do you mean? All right, if you really want me to cut them down, I'll bring it down to about 10,000 and see if I can take this army on. He says, no, even 10,000 is too many. And finally, it's reduced down to 300. Gideon is taught a lesson, but he does not know at what point this principle is actually emerging. Here it is. He takes these men to a riverside, and he asks them to drink water. And God tells them how he's going to select the right number in the manner in which they drink by the banks of that river. So it is not the specific and explicit teaching of the moment. It is incidental to what is going on, but it is instructive of what may legitimately go on. Here's my point. The first principle of pleasure is this. Anything that refreshes you without distracting you from diminishing or destroying your final goal is a legitimate pleasure. Any pleasure that refreshes you without distracting you from or in some way diminishing or destroying the final goal is a legitimate pleasure. If it's not distracting you, if it's not diminishing, and it is not destroying the final goal you have set, it is a legitimate pleasure. What do I mean by that? The most important point of reference for you and me then is to first settle what our goal in life is, what the purpose of life is. Once you've established that goal, then you know what diminishes, destroys, or distracts. If you don't have a goal, you'll never know what distracts you from it. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you don't know where you're headed, you'll never really know if you're moving in the wrong direction. You know, Susanna Wesley was the mother of 19 children. I shudder to think of the conversation at dinner time. She herself came from a family of 29. It was Susanna that had the impact upon her children, especially John and Charles. One became the sweet hymn writer, the other the profound evangelist covering two continents. One day, young John Wesley looked at his mother and said, Mother, can you give me a definition of sin? And John Wesley's mother said this, Son, whatever weakens your reasoning, impairs the tenderness of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, or takes away your relish for spiritual things. In essence, she said, if anything increases the authority and the power of the flesh over the spirit, that to you, John Wesley, becomes sin, however good it is in itself. Imagine that definition. If anything weakens your reasoning, impairs the tenderness of your conscience, obscures your sense of God, or takes away your relish for spiritual things, if anything increases the authority and the power of the flesh over the spirit, that to you becomes sin, however good it is in itself. You know what Wesley accomplished in a lifetime? And he wasn't a very tall man. 5'1 or 2 or something like that and change. Not exactly cutting an imposing figure when he stood in front of the masses. John Wesley in his lifetime preached 40,000. 1,000 sermons. Now, I don't know if you and I can really compute that in our thinking. Some of my years in my early 20s were spent in Toronto, Canada. Probably the best-known preacher out of Canada at that time was a man by the name of Oswald J. Smith. When Oswald J. Smith passed away, Billy Graham came to speak at his funeral. And Billy Graham was celebrating the fact that O.J., as he was known, preached 12,000 sermons in his life. Now, 12,000 sermons is a lot of sermons. But if 12,000 is a lot of preaching, what is 40,000? 12,000 in the day of technology, 40,000 in the day of the horseback. John Wesley was the original Sermon on the Mount. He mounted his horse and would go and preach. 40,000 sermons. He worked with 15 different languages, produced 600 pieces of literature, including those massive journals. At the age of 83, he was angry with his doctor because they wouldn't let him preach more than 14 times a week. At the age of 86, found written in his journal are these words: laziness is slowly creeping in. There's an increasing tendency to stay in bed after 5:30 in the morning. I try to console myself by saying he probably went to bed at 4 p.m. in the afternoon. You know. Think of the record of that kind of life. I strongly suspect, because it was instructed by a mother who reminded him how to stay away from that which would destroy the purpose for which he was called. How critical it is for you and me to know our calling. To know our calling. To know our purpose. Once you've established that, that gives you the precondition of determining what you say yes to and what you say no to. There are places you and I ought not to go. There's language you and I ought not to employ. There are habits that you and I dare not flirt with. You know, when I was a teenager and had just come to know Christ, one of my very close friends at that time, who ultimately has ended up becoming my brother-in-law, he was a brilliant young man, and we became very, very close friends. We played cricket together. We played tennis together. We were in the same neighborhood and grew up from the time we were 4 or 5 till our ways parted when we were 20, and then I moved to Canada. And a year or two after that, he moved as well, ultimately proposed to my sister. All along, I thought he liked me, found out he liked my sister, and he's my brother-in-law today. But we were part of a young people's group with Youth for Christ, and I'll never forget, shortly after our conversion, when we were in our teens, we were in a hill station for a summer camp in a city called Missouri, just about 120 miles plus or something outside Delhi. It's the foothill of the Himalayan mountains there, 7,000 feet altitude. About 45 of us kids were there, teens, for a camp. And on the last day, the speaker spoke on the theme, total surrender. We used to hear a lot of those kinds of sermons at that time. And when he gave the invitation, the room was just about emptied as most all of the teenagers walked up to the front. I'm always nervous giving this illustration a bit because it doesn't make me feel comfortable. It's a true story. There were a couple of sisters who didn't make that journey to the front. There was a sense of looking down upon those of us who had this spiritual inclination, and there was no response from them during the week. We still remained friends. There was a sneering attitude, and we just let it go. About 20-some years went by, maybe more. My brother-in-law and I were in Delhi. We were speaking at meetings, and the mother of these two girls phoned me in my hotel. She said, "Ravi, I hear you're in town. Would you be able to come and visit our home? My oldest daughter is in a very bad way. I'd love for you to come and pray for her." I was surprised that she even knew we were there. We took a cab, we drove over and arrived at the home. When the door was opened, it was the mother who opened the door, and she said, "My daughter is upstairs." So my brother-in-law Sundar and I went upstairs. When we walked upstairs, we were not expecting to see what we were going to see. She was shriveled up like this. Her cheeks were sunken. She looked nothing more than a bag of bones with the skin just pulled taut around her body. I said, "What on earth are we looking at?" And then the mother said to me, some time back, she and I got into an argument. She went into some of the prescription medication we had in the house, slammed the bathroom door shut, took an overdose of this medication. This is the result. And I looked at her, called her by name. I said, "Do you remember me? This is Ravi." And she just twisted and turned, almost agitated and unable to even control the saliva in her mouth, that is, as the drool was coming down of both sides of her mouth, struggling to say something, but she had no capacity for speech anymore. Our brother-in-law and I walked out of there numbed, dumbfounded. But there was a thought in my mind as I stood by that bed, and I said, "What are you doing in this condition? What happened?" Answers are never easy, especially if they're very simple, even simplistic. But I often wonder if that total surrender had come to Christ many years before, if this is where her life would have ended up, this way. You've got to set a goal. You've got to set a destination. You've got to set a point of reference by which you measure why you do what you do. If you don't set it, somebody else will set it for you. And oftentimes it'll be in a direction that God never intended for you. Matt, who travels with me and has been traveling with me now for a couple of years, he and I have gotten to know a young man who has become a very close friend. We were with him together last week, at least I was with him last week in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And again, we had a lot of time to talk while we were there, and he was talking to me about what his life used to be, because you could see the things that were going on with the World Cup around. And he said, "You know, once upon a time, this would describe who I was and define what I did." He said, "I just see it with eyes of pity right now." And what happened in his life as he went the way of pleasure, he said it all began on the first night of university when he crossed the boundaries that his parents had set for him. First night. And nearly wiped out his marriage and nearly wiped out everything else that his parents had ever given to him. But 7 years ago, he came to know Christ, and thankfully things have turned around. And so, especially for you men, I want to challenge you. How do you define what lines you cross? How do you choose what fences you erect? It's critical that we understand the terms of what it means when we don't set those boundaries and what it costs behind the scenes. Problem of pleasure, if anything refreshes you without distracting you from diminishing or destroying the final goal, it's a legitimate pleasure, which means set your final goal. There's a second principle that Boram gives us. It is this. David is at Adullam and the Philistines are at Rephaim. And David, and again, the Philistines have surrounded his home city. And David has got his soldiers around him, and he's tired in war. He does not feel like really going on anymore. War has taken its toll. And he leans back for a moment and just emotively cries out what he would long for. "Oh, that I could just get a drink of one glass of water from my well in Bethlehem." He wanted to taste the water from his home well in Bethlehem. The first time I read that, and then years later as I was reflecting on it, I traveled so much. I don't know what it, my wife's from Toronto. I don't know what it is about the city of Toronto. Every time you turn the faucet on and take a drink right out of the faucet, the water comes out so nice and cool. It's just the right temperature. Probably all that snow and ice that gets on that ground in the winter and just keeps it fresh enough. And oftentimes, as I used to travel, I'd say, boy, I'd love to just go to a faucet like that in Toronto and drink a refreshing glass of water. I travel all over the globe, and every now and then, like happened tonight while we left our hotel, there's something in my nostrils that can find an Indian restaurant where nobody else knows it even exists. And no sooner had we turned out of the restaurant when I looked to my left and I pointed to my two buddies here, I said, taste of India, right there, right there. Travel all over, what do you want at the end of it? A plate of food that you were accustomed to growing up with that brings back all the memories and all the loves and all of the relationships. It may be something extremely simple, but to your taste buds, it is so delicious, and that's what you actually long for. It's like traveling from America with a young teenager, and after about 2 weeks of it, they'd give all the gold in their pockets for a McDonald's hamburger or something like that. They just want a hamburger. They've been away from it for so long. David says, I wish I had a glass of water from the well in Bethlehem. Three of his best warriors overheard him. He didn't know what they were going to do. In a cloak and dagger operation, they got behind enemy lines, took a pitcher, filled it up from the water in the well in Bethlehem, came back to David. They loved David. They believed he was their deliverer. And they brought David and said, we got a surprise for you. Water from your well in Bethlehem. David is shocked. He said, are you boys kidding me? He said, no. So he takes that, he's about to drink it, and he stops. He pours it onto the ground. The reason he does that, he says, I have no right to be enjoying this pleasure while they risk their lives to bring it for me. It would be an illicit enjoyment. And the amazing thing is this, that if David had reacted the same way when he saw Bathsheba on the roof of her home, a lot of Old Testament history would have been different. Is that true? So here's the second principle. Any pleasure that jeopardizes the sacred right of another is an illicit pleasure. Any pleasure that jeopardizes the sacred right of another is an illicit pleasure. I remember in the throes of the early days of my ministry while I was traveling around and so much, I thought to myself, you know what? When I read that essay, I said, I don't think I'm the kind of person who would infringe on the sacred right of another. That's what I thought. And so you pat yourself on the back for that, you know. And then time goes by and you find out how subtle these temptations really are. They're very subtle. And many times I've looked at our three grown children now, two of them with children of their own. And I'm now in my late 60s, having crisscrossed this globe for four decades and missing out on some of the great moments of their childhood. And I say to myself, was that the price I extracted from them for something that I felt I was called to do? There is a price you may pay, you know. There is a price you may pay. By God's grace, He's given us three beautiful kids, all of whom are walking with the Lord, and I have the privilege of all of them working with me. But that's nothing because of what I did. It's because of the mother who was there constantly and the grace of God who somehow commandeered their lives and brought them to a point of surrender and commitment till all of them have very tender hearts for Christ. But I think today of how seductive the business world has become, how seductive even the ministry can become, how it can take you away from responsibilities and duties that are really primary for which God has positioned you and given you a time and a season. See, anything that jeopardizes the sacred right of another is an illicit pleasure. I wrote an article recently on duty. I called it a noble four-letter word. And I talked about the fact that liberal people don't like the word duty because it smacks of obligation. Conservatives don't like the word duty because they want to see the supremacy of love. You may honor your duty without love, but you cannot love without doing your duty. The loving thing God has called you and me to do has a duty to it, has a responsibility to it. When my father-in-law was passing away in his mid-80s, suddenly diagnosed with cancer and gone within 4 months from diagnosis to death, what he thought was a back pain from moving furniture, which turned out to be a tumor that was not curable, and we lost him within those 4 months, my father-in-law. I remember sitting around across a table from him in Toronto shortly before he passed away. He loved the word duty. I never heard him give a talk without quoting Lord Nelson, "England expects every man to do his duty." And he was sitting across the table and said, "Son, I don't know why it's happened so suddenly. I don't think I've got my finances in order to take care of Mama." And he went on. I said, "Dad, you have." He said, "No, I haven't." I said, "Yes, you have." He said, "How do you know I have?" I said, "I've already talked to your accountant. It's all in place." He was shocked. And I said, "Besides, Dad, even if you hadn't, can you not count on us to take care of her?" He stopped and said, "But son, it was my duty. It was my duty." And that piercing look in his eye told me he had that sense of responsibility for the loves to which he was committed. He went silent for 2 or 3 days before he died. He opened his eyes and uttered 2 sentences before he passed away. His daughters, 3 of his 4 daughters, standing around the bed. I was flying back trying to make it in time. He looked to the ceiling, my wife said, and he looked to the ceiling and he said, "Amazing, just amazing." And then he looked at his wife of 60-some years and said, "Jean, I love you." And he was gone. Beauty and duty came together in a fitting conclusion to a beautiful life. You and I must think of what we do, whether it ever jeopardizes the sacred right of another person. Because when that happens, you find a price is paid. You know, I hate to even introduce something so controversial as this, but as a preacher of God's word, I can't run from my responsibility. Think of the millions of babies that we have wiped out in the womb without giving them the privilege of opening their eyes into this world. Think of it. Cavalier way in which we make these decisions. Cavalier way. What do you think might happen if we stand before God and start complaining about all the problems we wanted to solve, which He didn't help us with? And God said, "Can I ask you something? I sent so many voices and so many minds to help solve those issues, you wouldn't even let them into your world." It's a very dangerous time in which we are living. Very dangerous time. Just this week, a defense expert has said that Al-Qaeda is developing a plastic explosive which cannot be detected by metal detectors and, in fact, which can be implanted in the human body. True or not, I don't know. Will it happen or not, I don't know. But you know, what do we say when that happens? Walk into a street and they blow themselves up. What is the first thing we say? How many children were destroyed? Innocent children were destroyed. we don't think of the innocent children we're destroying all the time and do it in some kind of noble rationalization. We're living in difficult times, dangerous times. I know you don't get popular speaking about these things, but I think about them a lot, and I ask myself this question: what's gone wrong? Where did we lose our markers? Second principle, that if you jeopardize the sacred right of another, you are in violation of God's order for pleasure. The third one, rather blunt, is in Proverbs 25 and 16. If you find honey, eat just enough of it, too much of it, and you will vomit. Not an aesthetic verse. If you find honey, eat it, but too much of it, and you'll be sick. You see, here's the principle. Any pleasure, however good, if not kept in balance, will distort reality or destroy appetite. Any pleasure, however good, if not kept in balance, will distort reality or destroy appetite. I love playing tennis. I can't now because of my back surgeries. But when I did play tennis, I also loved holding my wife's hand, but I couldn't do the two at the same time. There was a place for tennis, there was a place to hold her hand. There are pleasures we have, there are places of pleasure. There's a time to walk into a place of worship, there's a time to walk out of a place of worship. There's time to begin a hymn, there's time to close a hymn. There's time to begin a sermon and thank God, there's a time to end a sermon. You cannot simply go boundlessly and endlessly with one particular pleasure. If you take too much of it, it'll somehow diminish your, destroy your appetite, or it'll diminish the returns of what it is you are gaining from it. In brief, lead a balanced life. Lead a life that is balanced. A time for work, a time for play. A time to speak, a time to be silent, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, a time to plant, a time to reap. That's what Solomon said. There are different times and seasons in your life for various things. And so I bring you these three, that anything that refreshes you without distracting you from, diminishing or destroying your final goal is a legitimate pleasure. Anything that violates the sacred right of another is an illicit pleasure. Any pleasure, however good, if not kept in balance, will distort reality or destroy appetite. Keep your life in balance. And so I want to bring this message to a close, but I want to make it with four different applications. Number one, pleasure for pleasure's sake will leave you empty. Pleasure for pleasure's sake will leave you empty. It has to have a greater purpose than merely just enjoyment. In fact, I will go so far to say, as what G.K. Chesterton said, meaninglessness does not come from being weary of pain. Meaninglessness comes from being weary of pleasure. Meaninglessness does not come from being weary of pain. Meaninglessness comes from being weary of pleasure. Have you ever seen a person who's indulged and indulged and indulged, and he or she comes away then completely empty? I find it fascinating that on his deathbed, Oscar Wilde, looking at his lover Robbie Ross, asks him this question: Robbie, did you ever love any one of those young boys for their own sake? Imagine asking that on your deathbed, which is really asking what love is all about. Did you ever love any one of those boys for their own sake? And Robbie Ross says, no, I didn't, Oscar. Oscar Wilde says, neither did I. Bring me a priest, he said. Bring me a priest. If you haven't read his poem, The Ballad of Reading Jail, read it, where he talks about how only the blood of Christ was powerful enough to cleanse him from his sin. he'd reached that point of total emptiness by indulging in pleasure. Number two, all pleasure comes at a cost. For the true pleasure, you pay the price before you enjoy it. For false pleasure, you pay the price after you enjoy it. All pleasure comes at a cost. For true pleasure, you pay the price before you enjoy it. For false pleasure, you pay the price after you enjoy it. Number three, the closer you draw to good pleasure, the closer you will draw to the heart of God. The closer you draw to false pleasure, the farther away you will move from the heart of God. C.S. Lewis saw this in his book, Screwtape Letters. The senior devil is coaching a junior devil how to go and trip up a man who is getting closer to the enemy. The enemy is God, and the devil doesn't want him to get close to God. So he trains the younger devil. He says, go and distract him, waylay him. And he tries to work on him, but he doesn't win. The man goes all the way over to God's side. And when he comes back, the senior devil says to him, what went wrong? He said, I don't know. He said, the problem was every morning he took a nice, relaxing walk and he thought about good things, beautiful things. And then every day at the end of the day, he would read a good book which had good thoughts in it. And the devil said, that's where you blew it. When he took a walk, you shouldn't have allowed him to be spending time thinking of good things. You should have had him take a walk for the sake of exercise, and then it would have become a burdensome thing to him. And at the end of the day, when he read a book, you should not have allowed him to enjoy the book. You should have had him read a book so he could quote it to somebody else. He said, you allowed him to enjoy legitimate pleasure that drew him closer to the voice of the enemy, which was God. Good pleasure will draw you closer to God. Bad pleasure will take you away from him. And lastly, the greatest pleasure of all is to find beauty and integrity in worship. You must retain the integrity of worship. When you retain the integrity of worship, you worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness. Beauty has its absolutes. I want to close with an illustration that's one of my favorite stories of all time. I don't know, anywhere I go around the globe, people tell me, the story you told about this young man is my favorite of all, and I can't blame him. It's mine also. So let me close with this. When I was 25 years old, I was invited to go and speak in Vietnam by a missionary. And it's a long story how I even got there. I was in the middle of my theological training and to go to Vietnam. It was in the thick of the war in 71, 3 years after the infamous Tet Offensive, and a lot was going wrong at that time. So here I was, a single young man, and was hosted by the chaplains, and the American troops ferried me around, flew me around through the length and breadth, but most of it was done on motorbike with a 17-year-old young man. We'd pack our backpacks on, my Bible and sermon book. We'd go from town to town, from village to village, and I was speaking. Incredible. 17-year-old young Hien Pham. I was 25, cumulative age, 42. At the end of it, we left, and some years later, I was sitting at an airport reading a book on the history of the church in Vietnam. And it talks about a revival that broke out in 1971 when two young men were preaching through the country. I said, I think that's talking about Hien and myself being there. And sure enough, when they saw why it happened, I said, my word. I didn't know so much had happened as a result of those meetings. Then missionaries confirmed it. So when it was over in 71, August 71, I embraced him, said, Hien, I may never see you again. And bade him goodbye. 17 years later, I was in Vancouver, British Columbia. Late one evening, my telephone rang. And a voice on the other end of the phone says, Brother Rafi. I said, Hien? He said, how did you know? I said, you're the only one who melodically called me Brother Rafi. I said, is that you? He said, yes. I said, where on earth are you calling from? He said, from California. I said, what are you doing in California? He said, have you got some time? I said, sure. And so he started to tell the story. It was 1988. He says, Brother Rafi, after you left, the Viet Cong took over, overran South Vietnam. Many were arrested. I was arrested. I was put in prison. I was put in prison because they said I worked with the CIA. I told them I didn't. They said, oh, yes, you did. You interpreted for people. They even knew I was interpreting for you as a preacher and all this, and you'd come from the West. He said, they arrested me and put me behind bars. They took away my Bible. They took away all my English books. The only books they gave me were by Marx and Engels. Marx and Engels. Marxism, breakfast, lunch, tea, and dinner. That's all I could do. And in French and Vietnamese. No English. Marx and Engels, French and Vietnamese. He said, finally it got into my head, atheism. And I said, maybe they're right. Maybe they're right. All I've believed is false. And he said, Brother Rafi, I thought of you and the messages and the revival and all that happened. I said, maybe it's all nonsense. I went to bed that night and I said, God, I'm never going to pray to you again. I don't even know if you exist. No more prayers from me. He said, I woke up in the morning, decided I was not going to pray for the first time in many, many years. And I went to see the commanding officer and he assigned me to clean the latrines. I was going to clean the bathroom. He said, Brother Rafi, I don't know if you've ever seen a bathroom in a prison like that. He said, the whole stench in the air, and he went on and described the horrible place it was. He said, and at the end of it, he said, I had to cover my nose and my mouth so I didn't breathe that air. He said, I was dumping in a can full of used toilet paper, but paper with excrement on it, and I noticed one paper with English. He said, I looked around, hosed it off, put it into my hip pocket. He said, at night under the mosquito net when everybody was asleep, that damp piece of paper, I opened it, and on the top corner it said, Romans chapter 8. And he started reading, and we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? No, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us. For I'm convinced that neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, nor the present nor the future, nor any powers, nor height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus. He said, all alone under my mosquito net, I burst out crying. And I thought I'd wake everybody up. He said, I said, Lord, you wouldn't let me out of your reach for even one day. He said, on my knees, I resurrendered my life to Christ. I went the next morning to the commanding officer and said, do you mind if I clean the latrines again today? He said, I found out that the commanding officer had a Bible, and every day he was tearing pages from the Bible, using it for his toilet paper, dumping it into the can. I was washing it and having my devotions at night, every night. Finally, they released him. And he started to build a ship, a boat, that he could escape. And 52 others helped fund it, including, I think, the daughter or somebody of the vice president of Vietnam. So they were planning to escape. And one day, four Viet Cong came and to his door, pulled him out and said, are you planning to escape? He said, no. He said, are you telling us the truth? He said, yes. He said, telling us the truth? He said, yes. So they left. He said, after they left, I prayed a prayer that I hoped would never be answered. I said, God, I'm sorry I lied. If you really want me to tell them the truth, bring them back before we leave. And just hours before they would leave, these four boys, armed to the teeth, came, took him by the collar, rammed him against a wall. You are trying to escape, and you lied to us. He said, yes, I am, but 52 others, are you going to kill me? They said, no, we want to go with you. And four of them got onto the boat. He said, we were on the high seas. In a storm, we were capsized. These four boys knew exactly how to navigate and get us. We got to Thailand. I was in a camp, refugee camp. America opened its doors to me. I'm now doing my business degree at Berkeley, he said. He flew to Atlanta to meet my children because he wanted me to come and officiate at his wedding. And I'll never forget sitting around the table one night, young Hien Pham looked at my kids and he said, "You know, you'll wander all over the world. You'll go through all kinds of things trying to find happiness." He said, "I want to tell you, the answer is right here and now. It is intimacy with God." He said, "You find that intimacy with God and you will have the happiness you're looking for. You can find it anywhere in the world when you're walking closely with him." And you know, ladies and gentlemen, after 51 years of walking with Christ, having come to know him on a bed of suicide, I often wondered and looked back and said, only you could have pulled the threads together in an individual life the way you have done it. Only you, O sovereign God, and it is in him that I find my greatest pleasure. Is there a problem with pleasure? Yes. If you don't abide by those principles, you will go the wrong way. If you read Huxley's Brave New World and the George Orwell's 1984, George Orwell feared that what we hate would ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love would ruin us. Huxley was right. What we love today is not worth loving, and the nation is systematically being destroyed by the loves that hurt rather than the loves that heal, the love of God. Without that love, you cannot define any other love. At his right hand are pleasures forevermore. If you really want God's pleasure, learn to worship him in spirit and in truth. Here's what I'm going to do. I know it's not planned, but I'm going to bow my head in a moment of prayer. And if today you realize you've been headed in the wrong direction and you want to set it right, that you want to move towards the pleasure of God and his goodwill, when I'm closing in prayer, I'm going to ask you at that time to stand where you are, and I will say a special word of prayer for you. Will you bow your heads with me, please? And just stand where you are. Just stand up where you are. And by standing to your feet, you're saying, "Ravi, please pray for me. I am wanting to make some decisions." God bless you. God bless you. Yes. Just rise to your feet. Just rise to your feet. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Yes, several of you are standing up. If it's a habit that needs to be broken, if it's a direction that needs to be altered, if it's a passion that needs to be revoked, do it now and say to him, "This is my decision tonight, Lord. I want your blessing. I want the pleasure I pursue to be the pleasure that honors you." Yes, several of you standing. Continue to do it. I'm going to wait just a minute or two. Deal with God and rise to your feet. In doing that, you're saying, "Please pray for me." Yes, thank you. Thank you, several of you. Maybe a struggle, and I'm just going to wait about 30 seconds more, but this is your moment to turn your back upon that which is wrong and to turn your face towards that which is right. Will you stand? Would you stand? Father, for these that are at their feet right now, I pray it signifies an arm that is reaching out and a heart that is crying to you. Be with each one of them. We are hungry for you, Father. We need you. Even I reach out to you tonight to just help me be the kind of man you want me to be the person you want me to be. Bless every man, woman, young person standing at this moment And if there's somebody still seated who is struggling, even yet, Lord, prompt that heart to do it, to make that commitment. We need your blessing. We need the delight of pleasure that will honor you, and that we might receive that divine accolade someday. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thank you for this group of men and women. Thank you for its leadership. I pray its best years will be ahead. Let your benediction rest upon us in the name of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Amen and amen. God bless you. Thank you.